This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the violent play of children. Violent and aggressive behavior in kids is something that concerns almost everybody. It certainly concerns parents. It also concerns teachers. We're concerned when we see kids involved in violent play, perhaps inspired by violent movies that they've seen or violent video games, and we ask ourselves, how do we stop this? That's probably one of the first questions that parents, teachers ask. And then pretty quickly, you begin to discover that at very least, you can't just say, stop it, and expect the behavior to stop, because when the kids are off on their own, they're pretty much going to do whatever they want. Perhaps the key lies in understanding a little bit better where this comes from and what it's about. And we'll try to explore this territory this morning with our guest. Her name is Jane Catch. She is the author of a book that explores this territory, which is titled Under Dead Man's Skin, the subtitle Discovering the Meaning of Children's Violent Play. The book is published by the Beacon Press out of Boston. Jane Catch counseled emotionally disturbed children with Bruno Bettelheim at the famous Orthogenic School. She also taught kindergarten with Vivian Paley at University of Chicago Lab School. She now teaches young children in central Massachusetts. And the book is based on some of her classroom experiences as a teacher trying to confront this particular issue with her own students. And as we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. All we ask of people is that you try to be brief in your comments so we can keep things moving along. Anybody, though, is welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Catch, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
It does indeed seem to, this whole book and your thinking about the subject did seem to come from your reaction to the violent play that you saw the kids in your kindergarten class. These were, I guess, 5 and 6 year olds. Engaging in, and you were concerned about it. And as I said, it sounds as if you very quickly came to this realization that in the classroom you could say, we don't do that. But then once they got out of there and got out at the playground, they were going to pretty much do whatever they wanted. So it seemed that fairly quickly you came to the idea that just say no was not going to be a strategy that would work.
That's exactly right. I didn't like hearing it in the classroom, and I could make rules in the class that the children would have to go by because I was right there hearing them. But as soon as children are out playing on their own in the playground or also in their backyards at home, they're going to play the fantasies that are important to them. So I decided that it would be more helpful to them for me to understand what it was about this play that was so important to them and help them to be able to negotiate rules for keeping their play safe.
Mm-hmm. And the school where you were teaching, this was, and correct me if I have this wrong, but this was a private school. This was, and no doubt I'm sure the parents, or at least some of the parents, sent their kids there because they thought that it was a safe place, a positive environment for their kids, perhaps more safe, more positive than public school. And yet here, these children probably were not, I would imagine in many ways, would not end up being that different, at least in this dimension we're talking about, than children who would be going to the public school down the street or across town.
When I've talked to teachers from many different schools and daycare centers as well, it seems to be a problem that's pretty pervasive these days, that children are playing games that worry their parents and their teachers because of its violent content. Now, children have been playing games that involve violent fantasies for as long as I am aware of. When I was a kid, we played Cowboys and Indians or Peter Pan and the Pirates. But I think that the violent content of movies has become more explicit. And the children in this particular group, as well as in other groups that I've heard of, were playing games that had much more explicitly violent content.
The book, at the opening of the book, you talk about, the first chapter is titled The Suicide Game. You talk about this game that your children, your 5 and 6 year olds, invented. You said the 5 and 6 year olds in my class have invented a new game called Suicide. What is the Suicide Game?
Well, in this game, and I have to say I don't know where it came from that this age children were even familiar with the term, but in this game, some children were what they called the masters, and other children were what they called the slaves, and the masters would tell the children who were pretending to be the slaves what to do to commit suicide in some way. They would say, here, have this ball, and then after the child took it, they would say, actually, it was a bomb, and you're going to explode. And everyone was having a great time. The children who were pretending to explode were laughing, as well as the children who were giving them the script. And I was the only one who was uncomfortable with it, as far as I could see. But I felt as though some adult response was necessary for this. It didn't feel okay to me.
So what in your initial response was?
My initial response was to stop the game completely because it made me uncomfortable. But I realized after watching the children's play for a while that if I stopped a game like this, the violent content would come out in some other way. They would play a game that was a little bit different. They would pretend that their what had been their weapons a minute ago, their pointed fingers, were actually fire hoses. And they just became more deceitful about what they were playing. It was so clear that playing those games was something that was very important to them to do.
You shared your concern, I know, with other teachers and also with parents, and I'm expecting that as well the parents, some of them at least, had done what they could to raise peaceful children. These are the parents who perhaps the kind of parents of our generation who maybe we grew up one way, but then we thought, well, we're concerned about violence in kids, so we decided that we weren't going to give them toy guns.
Right.
And of course, but it didn't work.
Some of the children who loved this kind of violence in their fantasies were not allowed to play with toy guns at all. Others were. It didn't seem to be a direct connection between what the parents' rules were and whether the children were interested in this kind of play. Now, let me point out that when I'm talking about violence here, I'm not talking about children actually getting hurt. They could be playing with each other in ways that were very careful of their safety. We had several rules to ensure the safety of the children in their play. One was that even if they played a game that involved some kind of a violent fantasy, let's say they were pointing their finger and saying bang, they couldn't touch each other while they were playing that game. So no one was actually getting hurt in reality. It was a fantasy that was in the content.
And I thought that that's interesting that one of the things that you did, and you actually did this in collaboration with the children, was to develop some rules, and you came up with what you call the rules for, interestingly, you know, the rules for violence, that,
right.
to put some limits on the play and what you sort of could do and what you couldn't.
Absolutely. There were two kinds of rules. The first rules were the ones that I set as the teacher that protected the children's safety, both physical safety and emotional safety. And included in those rules were things like no touching when you pretend to fight, and no exclusion, the rule we called you can't say you can't play. Those were rules that I made to make sure that everyone was safe and was thriving in the classroom. Now, the rules that I encouraged the children to construct were rules about things where safety was not an issue, but they could make their own rules for the game that would make the game fair and would ensure that the game went well, so that when they came in from playing the recess game, they would come in settled without a lot of arguments left over from recess that were interfering with their classroom behavior.
Hmm. And that you were one of the things I guess you were concerned about was how recess, what happened after recess, and what sort of feelings and maybe excess energy and whatever the kids brought into the classroom, because certain you were interested in this idea, maybe what is it that I can do that the kids then will come back to the classroom and will be relatively settled so that we can then get down to doing some other things.
Exactly. When I started to look at this issue, I assumed that if the children played games with violent fantasy content out at recess, those were the days that they came into the room after recess and had trouble settling down. When we began to talk about recess when they came in, I discovered that that wasn't always the case, that in fact, on the days that they came in unsettled and upset, it was more likely to be because they felt the game wasn't fair or because some exclusion had been going on that made some children feel left out and angry. And that was what was bubbling over and coming back into the room afterwards.
And I think here this gets at what is a central sort of idea and a kind of understanding that I think you came to as a result of thinking about it and also talking with the children about it. And I guess one boy in particular who was a little bit older than the children that you had in your class. And this seems to be, it seems to me to be an important insight, and it's probably also one of those that when we start talking about it, people will say, well, of course, as if everybody knew that. And yet, I think that it is a, I'm not sure that that is something that we really do recognize. And this is, all this is by way of saying that you're kind of the idea that you came to was that one way and another, that violent behavior in children, perhaps violent game playing at the very least, is a response, grows out of their feelings of vulnerability.
That's right. And in fact, there were very few incidents of any actual violence during their play. This was a group that played together quite well in terms of not hitting each other or losing their temper. But the incidents that did happen revolved around exclusion, where a child would be excluded and called a name. Mama's little baby was one example. And then other children felt as though they could push that child down because he was in this other category that they weren't in. And when I talked to older children about the issue of violence, they gave me several similar examples of times in their lives when they had been called a name and hit or knocked down, and apparently for no other reason, more or less out of the blue. So it began to seem to me as though exclusion had two connections with violence. One was that an excluded child could, over time, become very angry and feel as though violence was justified to rectify the situation because he had been so badly treated by his peers. And the other incidents were ones where children excluded someone and then felt justified in hurting that child because he was excluded.
Hmm. So that just, I suppose one of the, one idea you come away from this is with is the basic idea that for all of us, and it probably doesn't depend on what your age is, that being, feeling accepted, being included, is a very important thing, and that that we're also very sensitive about our identities. And when someone comes along and knocks you, that's a really uncomfortable, painful thing. And perhaps we wouldn't, one might respond to that by withdrawing in a social and psychological way, but also one might respond by acting out.
That's right. Children did describe situations like that where, having been called a name or excluded, they felt as though they had the right to lash back at the people who had been excluding them.
Hmm. Where, now, I guess there's a question there. Where is that a natural response or is that a learned response? And if it's a learned response, then where do they get the idea that somehow that's justified or perhaps called for, that is to lash out in response for being excluded?
It seems to start very early, and I can't answer the question about whether it's natural or learned, but in teaching even younger children, 4 and 5-year-olds, I've noticed that it seems as though as soon as the children are aware that there's a group out there that they would like to belong to, they very often exclude someone else from it.
Hmm.
It seems to make them feel more secure in relation to that group, to be able to say to somebody else, you're not in it.
It also invites some thought, at least, about whether whether somehow fundamental to our nature is the idea of hierarchy. There is a section in the book, and I suppose one could go too far with this, but where you were visiting a friend who had puppies, and you spend some time watching them, and one of the things we know about dogs is that they are domesticated wolves. And you can learn a lot about dog behavior, I'm told, by looking at wolves and how they behave. They're pack animals, and hierarchy, though, is very important, and individuals will rise as high in the group as they can, and they're sort of programmed to do that. Then you can see the consequences. Of course, if you have a dog and you're interested in raising them and training them, you better sort of understand those things too. Then we come to look at the question, okay, now by looking at that, can we, at the same time being careful about just how far we take that, can we then draw some lessons about human behavior and human motivation?
I'm not a naturalist, and so I also was careful about the parallels that I made, but I was struck watching these puppies at some of the similarities between their play and the play that I was seeing in school, and it was fascinating to me. For example, there was a child in the class who was constantly seeming to need to express his importance in terms of gaining power over other children. And if someone else had something, he wanted it, or he would try to get one better than whatever it was. And when I watched these puppies, they were playing the same game where one of the lead puppies would see another puppy with a stick and immediately go to get that stick. And then as soon as he got that, he would look for what another puppy had and would go after that one. And although I think you can take that too far, because of course there are many differences between children and puppies, it was helpful to me to see the play in that perspective, because it made me feel as though this wasn't a mean kind of play that was going on. It wasn't intended to be hurtful to the other child whose, you know, stick was being taken away. It was a testing of strength in a way that's pretty normal and a lot more understandable.
And this gets us into territory that's sort of difficult, because that is thinking about human behavior and what determines it, how much of it might be programmed into us, and how much of it is result of socialization. And in recent years, I think people have written all sorts of things about what about our current day behaviors are a result of our long heritage and can go back to long, long time ago, and when people lived different ways than they do now. But you do sort of wonder how one balances the two tendencies that I think we see in human beings. One is this tendency to engage in this kind of trying to climb on top of the other person activity and rising as high in the group as you possibly can, and perhaps some suggestion that aggressiveness is natural. The other, that one would argue the reason human beings have been successful is that they are also by their nature cooperative, and that people do sometimes make decisions. They do things that are good for everybody, not just necessarily that's good for just them. So if we recognize that we have some of both of those things in us, and then we also recognize that we'd say, well, I think we'd like to try to encourage one and in some sense dampen down the other, how is it actually possible to do that?
I think it is possible to do that. And it was one of the most rewarding parts of the year with these children, was watching that happen. The way it worked in my class was when the children would come in from play feeling upset, we would talk about what had happened, and we would make rules about how to make the play go more smoothly. Now, when we had those discussions, the ground rules for the process were that every child who wanted to speak could speak and would be listened to, so that all opinions first would be put out for everyone to hear. And then we would come to some kind of a compromise that would enable all the children playing the game to feel good about the new rules. So that rather than voting in a situation where almost half the children could be unhappy, they had to accommodate every child's needs in the game, which meant a very careful process of listening to each other and coming up with compromise that satisfied everyone. So in that process, the children both were able to express their needs to play aggressively, but also had to really listen to each other in a way that was very constructive for the whole group.
Mm-hmm. We're just about at the midpoint already of this conversation in this hour of focus, and I have a caller we will talk with in just a moment. I should introduce again our guest. Her name is Jane Catch. She teaches young children in central Massachusetts. She counseled emotionally disturbed children with Bruno Bettelheim at the Orthogenic School. She also taught kindergarten with Vivian Paley at the University of Chicago Lab School. She's written about her experiences this year that she spent with the 5- and 6-year-olds, and in which she did a lot of thinking about children's violent play. She describes all of this in her book, Under Dead Man's Skin. The subtitle is Discovering the Meaning of Children's Violent Play. It's published by the Beacon Press. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to talk with on our line number one. Hello.
I'm struck on several of your examples of the sameness between some adult behavior and some group adult behavior and the children's behavior that you're describing. And how else to describe how some of us treat homosexuals, for instance. We separate them, and then some people feel that that is an excuse for violence against them. Same thing was true of those who were considered outcasts, Jews, homosexuals, gypsies in Germany. There was some other example that you gave, and now in a long time since I first called, now I've forgotten what it was. But it would seem that some of us haven't grown up, or that these childhood issues and traits continue on in a large number of people. Oh, I know what the other example was, that in a couple that's separating, where one of the people tends to be violent. The most dangerous time is during that rejection when, for instance, when a divorce is being finalized or so forth, when the woman is trying to get away, as an example. It seems to me that's the same thing as what you're talking about, where a child who feels rejected feels that it's okay to respond with violence. Any thoughts?
I'm having trouble with my connection. Could you repeat that? David, could you repeat that question for me?
I think that the caller was suggesting that you can see in adults essentially the same kind of behaviors, and that particularly when we talk about outgroups in society, gays and Jews, minority groups, that some of the same kind of behaviors are exhibited by adults, and perhaps her suggestion is that maybe some of that adult behavior grows out of these childhood issues that we have been talking about, and it's something that people can carry with them for a long time.
That certainly is my hope, that by helping children to understand at a very young age that differences of opinion are interesting And you can listen to other people's opinions, learn something from that, and come to some kind of accommodation so that everyone can make rules for safety and for the benefit of the whole group. I'm hoping that having those experiences as young children will be something they'll remember as they get older.
Hmm. Very interesting. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. And other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Something that I think also is interesting that you write about is how these behaviors differ along gender lines, and that that boys and girls do engage in some of the same kind of behavior, although perhaps they do it in different ways. Essentially, it's the same.
There were more boys than girls by far in this group who were interested in this kind of violent fantasy. But there were girls who enjoyed it, either consistently or from time to time. It seemed to me in this group more frequent that the girls would stop to wonder about it and that they would want to be looking around while they were playing to make sure that everybody was okay during it. For example, one day at lunch, one of the girls was watching some boys talk about their battleship that they had made out of popsicle sticks in the morning, and she said, "Why do boys like that so much?" Another example was a girl playing in the midst of the boys' violent fantasy, who would want to make sure that everybody had a role that was okay for them. And she said to one boy, "You know, if you don't get a part that you like, tell me. I'm the mother, and I'll help you." So that seemed to be more typical of a girl's role.
Hmm. And again, that invites the question: where at 5 or 6, why should there be that difference, and why even at that age should girls, or some girls at least, be so concerned about that issue of getting people included and getting people taken care of?
It was a fascinating question to me, too, and I don't know the answer to that, although I did notice when I was looking at my friend's puppies that she had a female puppy that did the same thing. While we were talking, she came over to my friend and started making little puppy noises. And when we went out to look, two of the boy dogs had knocked over the garbage can.
And she was coming in to say, "The boys are misbehaving."
That's right.
Oh, that's very interesting. Although the girl, it does seem that some of the girls at least were capable of doing the same sort of exclusion
Of
thing
girls
about,
have their
you
own
know, they just,
ways.
They are doing it differently, but they're also doing it.
They were quieter about it, certainly in this group. One girl would compliment everyone in the group of girls around her, compliment their clothes, except for the one girl that she didn't care for. And so it was very hard for me to pinpoint what was going on that was making this girl feel excluded, because you can't exactly criticize somebody for not complimenting another person. But the girl who was doing the exclusive complimenting knew what she was doing, because as soon as she saw that I was watching her, she complimented the last girl.
Hmm. Let's talk with some other folks here. Another Urbana person, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to make a couple of comments about a couple of studies that were done. And one is that a study was done with children from the United States, children from a third world country, and children in England. And the setup was that the children had to cooperate in order to reach a common goal. And the children in the third world country did this automatically without any suggestions whatsoever. The children in England had to be coaxed a little bit. The children in the United States never got it. And the assumption was that this is such a competitive society, and we foster it by all of the competitive sports, the comparing of grades, clothes, et cetera, in school, that it doesn't occur to children that they can cooperate, even when there is a valued goal to be reached by cooperation. It is just not in their experience. And the other situation was one which I did myself. I didn't set it up as a test, but it sort of turned out to be that way. And this was with high school kids, actually honor juniors in a high school, where I was subbing one day, and they were pretty rambunctious. So I suggested a kind of game, and that was that it was a class in creative writing. I suggested that verbally we make up a story where one person would do the first sentence and then pass it around the room. And I reviewed what makes a short story, you know, to develop a characterization, to lead up to some kind of a climax and then some kind of a resolution, et cetera, and et cetera. So the first person gave one statement and one sentence, and the next person immediately introduced some kind of violence. The next person introduced violence which had nothing to do with the violence before that. And it went on and around the room. Again, I reiterated what made up a short story, the qualities that were necessary. They were never able to move away from the violence. And my assumption was that they don't have any choice. Their imagination is, you know, there's such a poverty of imagination. And I think they get it from television, not because of the content of television so much as that there is never any choice about what is going to happen next. It is always aimed towards violence. And I would like to hear some comments about that. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, certainly the caller raises a number of interesting points. And I wonder what you think about that, Ms. Katz, maybe starting with the first idea that perhaps what this is a symptom of is the fact that American society is highly competitive, and we train children to be competitive.
I think that the reassuring piece of that disturbing study, I guess you could say, is that I think that children can learn to be more cooperative. And the fact that they are doing it more in third world countries or more in England maybe confirms that idea. And I see as the year goes on in my class where we're working on those issues so consistently all year, that as the year goes on, the children are able to solve more and more of their problems themselves. In the beginning of the year, I really have to spend a lot of classroom time working on compromises. And then as the year goes on and they begin to be able to listen to each other and negotiate compromises and agreements, they'll come in from recess and tell me about something that they've worked out themselves. And then, toward the end of the year, they didn't even always tell me. They just knew that this was something that they could do. And parents would report that they heard it at home with the neighborhood children or with siblings, and the children were learning to do that on their own. So I do think that it's something that when we adults emphasize it, children can really learn to do it.
Mm-hmm. The other story that the caller told reminds me of one of the sections of the book, actually. You talk about the fact that at one point during the year, a niece of yours, who was a college sophomore, had was just back from Zimbabwe in Africa, where she had been working at a school for physically handicapped children. And she came back and she showed you some pictures of some of the kids and talked about that. And you asked her to come in and talk with your students, which she did. And then at one point you asked her to tell a story, a kind of a traditional African sort of story, which was rather gentle in nature and about things like overcoming your fears and unreasonable fears and working together and cooperating, and, you know, a lot of good positive values. And then you tried to get the children to make up stories in that style with some of those sort of values, and it seemed that they just couldn't. And it gets back to this, perhaps also to the issue of media and exposure to media, and whether or not we have stories that we can tell and can make up that help to put across the values that we would like children to have. It seems that we have a difficult time coming up with stories like that.
I think that's true, and I think there are two issues here. One is, what are the stories that as a culture we're giving to our young children? Traditionally, cultures have taught children through stories, emphasized the values of the culture at a level that a child is ready to understand. And as the child grows older, the stories can become more complicated, or they can get deeper meanings out of those same stories. Now, it does seem as though we're more and more presenting our children with stories that are not intended to be for their growth and for the growth of their moral values in our culture. Certainly, the children are being bombarded with a lot of stories that are just either for the excitement or pleasure of people who have made them up, or are for the purpose of making money and selling movies. So it's a very different kind of story that our children are hearing. So that's one piece. And the other piece is whether the children have time to play their own stories, because I think that's where a lot of constructive imagination comes from, is the ability to have the time to know what one's own stories are and to play them out with other children who can hear them and add to them and change them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of children are too busy.
Well, and this, again, it gets me to the thinking about the issue of media and violence, which is something certainly that's good to be thinking about, but that perhaps you need to look at it at a somewhat deeper level. That is, yes, we probably should be concerned about violent entertainment and children seeing that. But as perhaps as important, maybe a little bit more important, is to go beneath the surface and say, what actually is the story here? What's the point that's being made? Is there indeed any point that's being made? And that those values maybe are going to be important or problematic. And we ought to be thinking about that, too, in addition to this issue of violence.
Right. I think, for instance, fairy tales have quite a lot of violent content. But they're usually, first of all, moral, because the hero or heroine is overcoming obstacles to meet an important goal. And second of all, they're tailored to the age of the child that's going to be listening to them. So if you have a young child and you're telling fairy tales or reading fairy tales to that child, you'll pick the ones that are appropriate for that child's age, and you're likely to see the child's reaction and see whether it's too frightening, and if it is, you'll tone it down or pick a different story. So I think the relationship with the child hearing the stories is also important.
Mm-hmm. This is certainly something that I don't know if mentor is the right word to use, but Bruno Bettelheim wrote a lot about this. This is something he was particularly interested in.
That's right. He thought there was a tremendous value in fairy tales, in imparting the culture and the values of the culture to children. But also, he actually went as far as to say that it was better to tell a story to a child than to read it, because when you told it, first of all, the pictures that might be in a book wouldn't interfere with a child's own imagination. And secondly, because you would change the story to suit that child and what that child needed.
Yeah, perhaps people who are interested in that should seek out his book, The Uses of Enchantment, which I think is he has some interesting things to say. I don't know if everyone would agree with the psychoanalytic orientation, but I think it's interesting nonetheless.
Right, I agree.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. We have another caller here. Let's go to Bloomington, Illinois, line number 4.
Thank you very much. I just have 2 points and questions. One is about the boundaries of school learning. That is, most schools stop the school learning at the playground, and perhaps it's at the playground at play where a great deal of learning takes place. And associated with that, do you think that children are moral reasoners, that they can actually do critical thinking and reflecting on this, and that schools don't do enough to encourage or stimulate critical thinking about issues, social and moral issues? Third, the question, the relationships between gender exclusion and violence, if it were true that, let's say, that girls excluded more than boys, what does that do to the relationship you have found between boy exclusion and violence? Thank you very much. I'll just hang up.
Okay.
Okay. First of all, I agree about the importance of the playground. I think that that children can, if they're helped, learn a lot about how to get along with other people, how to listen to other people, and how to understand that other children can have feelings about something that are different from their own, but also valid and important to take into account.
Yeah,
I think that the playground is a really important place.
It's interesting. I think you make the argument that at some places where they've decided for, I don't know, for reasons of economy or because they wanted to have more classroom time, that they could safely get rid of recess. You seem to be suggesting, no, that's not, maybe not such a good idea.
Yes, that's for sure. I think children need recess for lots of reasons, and it includes physical exercise as well as those other social skills.
Mm.
I also agree with the caller about the importance of critical thinking, and I think that having time to hear other people's points of view and to have time to learn to express one's own thoughts and hear other people's reactions to them is really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And the third issue that he brought up about gender is a really complicated one. I'm not sure that girls do more excluding than boys do, but it certainly, in this group, took a different flavor. It was quieter and more subtle. But it would be hard to compare who was doing more excluding. The boys' exclusion was noisy, and when it took place, I knew it right away. Whereas the girls' exclusion, I had to really look for it and watch what was going on in order to see it happening. But they both did it.
Do you feel that at the end of the year, that the things that you had learned and tried to do with the children led to changes in their behavior? Could you really see differences at the end?
I really did see differences. If you look at the conversations that the children had about problems that were coming up at recess, at the end of the year, they were often able to go through a discussion of what happened and what could happen next in order to make a situation that had upset them work out better. They were able to really do that in large part by themselves. I would be there listening to them and helping them keep on track, but they could come up with solutions, whereas in the beginning of the year, it was much more difficult for them to both explain what the problem was and come up with possible suggestions for what to do about it. So it wasn't that all difficulties disappeared. It was more that they had tools for how to deal with them when they came up, which was actually the goal. So that when problems like this come up in their backyard or out at recess when the teachers aren't listening, they'll have some ideas of how to handle it.
I want to try to bring one more person in here as we're down to our last minute or two. In Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi. Just a quickie. I've only heard half of your program, and I wish I'd heard it all. But when I was teaching long ago, I enjoyed using Aesop's Fables. And I found that the class would really have a very animated reaction to them and the whys and wherefores. And I wondered if you had talked about that earlier on this program or if you have used Aesop's Fables.
I haven't used Aesop's Fables as much in particular as I did fairy tales.
Uh-huh.
But I do think that the idea of teaching through stories
uh-huh.
is really valuable. Children can talk about what was fair in a story and what a character should have done
Excellent.
In a way that really helps them be able to articulate their opinions, listen to other people's opinions, and imagine what they would do in a similar situation. And also, after the story is over and they're playing a game and some situation comes up, you can refer to that and go back to it and say, remember the day we talked about, you know, this character? What do you think is similar about your new situation, and what did you learn from that?
The reason I like the fables is they're very short and pithy.
That's right.
And that can be a problem if the class or some of the members of the class don't get it. But it would fill in other places when you have a little bit of time. And I just found those very, very helpful. Besides, I like to go back to some of the old things, as you say, fairy tales. And I just wanted to put my my 2 cents in for Aesop's Fables.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, we're going to have to stop as we're here at the end of the time. Again, if folks want to look at the book, I think there's some interesting things here. You'll look for Under Dead Man's Skin, Discovering the Meaning of Children's Violent Play, published by the Beacon Press, by our guest Jane Catch. Ms. Catch, I want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.